This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Oscar season is finally upon us. The studios are now releasing the movies they hope will get them a nomination. It's Friday, so it's time to talk about these new movies opening this weekend. Joining me now, Christy Lemire. She writes for RogerEbert.com and is co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. Hi, Christy.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you. And William Bibbiani, co-host of the podcasts Critically Acclaimed and Canceled Too Soon. Hi there.
Hello.
All right, let's begin with Dr. Sleep, based on Stephen King's best-selling novel of the same name, of course, a sequel to The Shining.
I need you to listen to me. The world's a hungry place. A dark place.
Hi there.
I only met two or three people like us. They died. When I was a kid, I bumped into these things. I don't know about magic. I always called it The Shining.
Okay, Ewan McGregor there playing the grown-up Danny from the original. And?
And he is starring in one of the best films of the year. Dr. Sleep isn't just a sequel to The Shining. I think it is an incredibly potent horror film about struggling with addiction and childhood trauma. And on top of that, it is an incredibly smart and profound amalgamation of Stephen King's original vision for The Shining, which differed very, very much from what Stanley Kubrick did with
it. He hated Stanley Kubrick's version.
It very, very much. And although the movie takes Kubrick's film as canon, it has a lot of elements from that visually and characters and locations.
Are we back in The Overlook?
Yeah, you'll see in the trailer. That's not a spoiler. We do see The Overlook again. I think Mike Flanagan, who is perhaps best known now for doing the Netflix series Haunting of Hill House, he understands that Kubrick's version is significant and valid, but so is Stephen King's. So what we have here is an attempt to take the original Kubrick film of The Shining and all of its horror and all of its trauma and use it as only one perspective on those events. And now that Dan has grown up and Dan is struggling with his own alcoholism, he is starting to see different sides of The Shining and of his father that he never had before. Mm. When he is thrust into another supernatural situation, he is determined to handle it a different way.
Oh my gosh. Okay, Christy.
I am not as enamored of this film as Bibbs is. I liked it for the first 2 hours. And then
there's more than two
hours.
It's
2.5 hours long. And eventually you do get back to The Overlook. I liked it a lot until you got to that point, because what they do, as Bibbs was saying, as far as exploring what Danny has gone through and learning to live with this ability that he never wanted and has traumatized him all these years of his life, he gets to a point where he can use it for good. And there's such poignancy and just delicacy in the way that he does that. It's really quite lovely. But he has to fight this band of they're like evil Stevie Nicks gypsies, right? They are.
They're awesome. They're totally
sing?
Awesome.
Do they twirl around?
They do. They have jaunty hats and lots of bracelets. But they go after people who have this shine. They call it the steam, and they want to capture that power. And terrifying stuff happens in this film. What happens to several different children in this movie is horrifying and very, very hard to watch. It's extremely tense for the first 2 hours, and then the last half hour feels like fan service to me, in that they recreate a lot of specific things from The Shining in a way that just sort of feels like, oh, there's a thing I know, and there's a thing I know, and oh, there's a really obscure thing I know.
I will say it takes a lot of chutzpah to take on Stanley Kubrick.
It does. It absolutely does. And I don't know if most filmmakers could have pulled it off as well as Mike Flanagan. I see Christie's point about the finale and what it does with the Overlook Hotel. I don't think that's mere fan service. I get that. I've heard people say that, but I don't think it's that at all. And I think if it was that, I think the movie is clever enough that I don't think it would be there if it was.
Well, do we see the iconic scenes recreated? The rivers of blood.
Yeah, a little, yeah.
The creepy twins. Mm-hmm.
The carpet.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Not all of them, but yeah, a fair amount.
Okay, moving on to Marriage Story. Christy, you saw this one. It's a drama starring Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson, a couple getting a divorce.
What I love about Nicole, she is a mother who plays, really plays.
What I love about Charlie,
he loves being a dad. He loves all the things you're supposed to hate, like waking up at night.
She knows when to push me and when to leave me alone.
He never lets other people keep him from what he wants to do.
Dad, you're too far.
I know. It's not easy for her to close a cabinet.
He's incredibly neat.
She's brave.
He's brilliant. He's very competitive.
Okay, so I guess that's when they liked each other.
Well, this is excellent, first of all. Let me just say that. This script is beautiful and devastating. But what you just heard in that clip was the very beginning of the film, where you hear them in voiceover saying nice things about each other, and then you realize that that is mandated as part of their therapy. Like, at the beginning of this film, their marriage is already falling apart. There's no hope. It's not about will they or won't they stay together for each other, for the son. It's going to happen, and it's a matter of how do they navigate the unknown territory of that and the really harsh emotional terrain of that. So Scarlett Johansson plays an actress. Adam Driver plays a theater director. They've been married for about 10 years, and their marriage is collapsing. She wants to move to L.A. to do a TV pilot. He wants to stay in New York because his play is about to go to Broadway, and they have this son who's about 6 years old. Each of them thinks that one of the coasts is where they belong.
Shades of Kramer versus Kramer.
Very much so. It does feel a lot like that in the naked, raw honesty of it. Noah Baumbach wrote this. It comes from a very personal place. It is partially inspired by his own divorce from Jennifer Jason Leigh. It's clearly very personal in that the things that Scarlett Johansson and Adam Driver say to each other ring with such truth over and over and over again. And you feel like you are truly eavesdropping on painfully personal moments. There's a big fight scene between the two of them, which is just devastating. But leading up to that, there are some surprisingly funny moments. There's some sort of surreal humor in the way like family members and friends and both of their lawyers deal with this. Laura Dern is fantastic as Scarlett Johansson's lawyer. If you liked her in Big Little Lies, This is a similarly kind of, you know, showy, sexy, brash role for her. Alan Alda is great as Adam Driver's lawyer, who is much more subtle and it's very heartfelt. This is just tremendous, and it has to be seen. It's sad, ultimately hopeful, but it's always true.
Yeah. Well, with divorce, it is.
It's a good date movie.
Both. Mm-hmm. It's a good date movie, especially if you're married.
Yeah, I'm curious, actually, because I want to know before I go this weekend. Should I bring the family? Should I?
I think it is a good date movie.
Okay.
It is. It, in that, it will give you a lot to talk about afterward.
Okay. I love it when people tell me we need to talk. I'm like, great, cool. This will be a wonderful thing.
Okay. Moving on to another searing family drama, Honey Boy. This is written by Shia LaBeouf about his own life as a child actor. He stars as his own dad.
You have good instincts.
I have good instincts?
Yeah,
I got rodeo clown instincts. Well, I could never make it in Hollywood.
You could if you start when I did.
How do you think it feels to have my son paying me? How do you think that feels?
You wouldn't be here if I didn't pay you.
Sounds pretty intense. What did you think, Bibbs?
It is intense. It's clearly an intensely personal film for him. And when you're watching Honey Boy and you're watching a young Shia LaBeouf, the names have been changed. He calls himself Otis in this, but you're watching a young Shia LaBeouf at this like motel off the freeway as he's being driven back and forth from various kids shows.
He lives in this motel with his dad.
Yeah.
He doesn't really work. And
No, his dad is paid to chauffeur him around, basically, because his dad has a really bad criminal record and he can't get any work anywhere else. And the dad is emotionally abusive, eventually physically abusive, and you get the impression that you're watching a really intense hour and a half of Shia LaBeouf's therapy sessions, which is fascinating and intensely emotional. But at the same time, I don't feel like it's a movie that's made for the audience. I think like a movie that's made for Shia LaBeouf. That's not a bad thing. I think there's a certain amount of indulgence that comes in a lot of art. And I think Shia LaBeouf has clearly thought a lot about his relationship with his father and what it means to him, and some of the dialogue from older Shia LaBeouf, played by Lucas Hedges, as he is considering what his dad has done to his life, is actually very potent and valuable. But it's so personal and so intimate that watching it makes me feel almost rude.
Really,
you know, like I'm intruding on his,
intruding on his life. Yeah.
But I'm impressed by how personal he was able to make this feel and how intimate it feels.
But in the pantheon of Shia LaBeouf performance artist stunts, this is the most accessible and it feels the most honest. Like the other ones came from a place of like he's working through some stuff, but there's also like a provocative element to it. This just it feels very raw. And I'm not sure if I felt rude watching it, but I felt fascinated always. And I appreciate the length to which he is willing to go to explore his past and get to the truth. And then at the end, you see over the credits, you see actual photos of Shia LaBeouf mm-hmm. as a child with his actual father. And you see the attention to detail as far as physically capturing what his father looked like back then. Noah Jupe is great mm-hmm. as the younger version of Shia LaBeouf, this precocious kid who's talented beyond his years and has to bear the brunt of just horrendous physical and verbal abuse from his dad.
There's this great scene in the movie where he's talking to his mom on the phone and his dad's in person, and his dad refuses to talk to his mom, so he's telling his dad everything his mom says, but he's giving a performance as his mom. One of the best action scenes of the year. It's so good.
Wow. Are you saying yes, go see it? Or...
Yeah, I am.
Okay. I think so. I think so as well. You need to be aware that you're going to be watching some very emotional, intense, it feels like a therapy session, yeah. but if you're down with that, it's a good film.
But there's reconciliation at the end, I feel like.
To an extent, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Christmas movies are already out, Christy.
Oh, yes.
Wow. Okay, this one that's out this weekend is called Last Christmas, and it stars Emilia Clarke and Henry Golding.
You, again.
I'm Tom.
Did you follow me here?
Are elves always so cynical?
Relentlessly, these are dark times.
You should come with me, then.
Has anyone ever told you there's something slightly serial killery about you?
No, never more than once, anyway. I really enjoyed our walk today.
Ditto.
Is the twist that he's a serial killer?
If only.
Okay, Christy, you're up.
Okay, so Emilia Clarke and Henry Golding meet cute in an adorable, idyllic London where she works as an elf at a year-round Christmas store.
She's not David Sedaris.
I have seen a Hallmark movie with this exact plot already.
Michelle Yeoh is her boss, and she's pretty funny. Henry Golding is impossibly handsome and dashing and charming. It's interesting. They have swapped the genders of the usual romantic comedy tropes here. Like, he's the manic pixie dream girl, and she is the mess whose life needs rescuing and whose faith in humanity needs restoring. Paul Feig directed this. Emma Thompson co-wrote the script. Emma Thompson plays Emilia Clarke's mom. And they fall in love in London, but he's not who he perhaps seems he is.
Is he Santa?
What? He's elusive. It's funny. Michelle Yeoh's character is named Santa, actually.
Michelle Yeoh is Santa. Yes, I'd pay to see that.
Yes, but you think. But he's charming, but he's sort of elusive, too. And then she learns to believe in humanity again. And the music of George Michael is a through line because the name of the movie is Last Christmas.
I get it.
Right?
And we all remember that video.
Right. And throwing snowballs and mm-hmm. his hair was perfect at all times. So if you love George Michael like I do, theoretically, that should be enough. But even my deep-rooted love of George Michael is not enough to make me recommend this movie because the pieces just aren't, they don't fall into place. They're all there, but it never gels and it's edited in a really erratic way. And then the ending is going to make you mad. That's all I'm going to say.
I want to see the movie, but more than I want to see the movie, I want to see a montage of Emma Thompson writing the movie, just like at her thing, and then listening to every George Michael song, and then it does like a smash cut to her dancing around her incredibly fancy office with posters of Sense and Sensibility in it. That's what I want.
I would have preferred that.
Yeah.
Well, it's not going to be the last Christmas movie we talk about, I'm
true,
sure.
True. Yeah.
So there's that.
I'll give you my heart today and every day, Madeline.
Yes, indeed.
I get it.
Don't give it away.
Christy LeMayer writes for RogerEbert.com and co-host of the podcast Breakfast All Day. William Bibbiani, co-host of the podcasts critically acclaimed and canceled too soon. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Last Christmas.
Coming up, comedian Maz Jobrani is here to talk about how he milks the headlines for his stand-up. That's next on Press Play.